Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And Leo.
We're here tonight to bring you some headline news, and then following that, we're going to bring you an interview with the director. Was he the director of the Palestinian Center?
Yes, executive director, yeah.
Yosef, and I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name.
Manyar.
I never get it correct. And the interview with him was very informative. Give you an idea of what the Palestinian Center tries to do and how they are trying to help Americans understand what the Palestinian issues are, because so far in this country, at least in Washington, D.C., there doesn't seem to be a great deal of sympathy for the Palestinian issues and the issues of those people. So that's what his mission is, and that'll be on in about a half hour.
So, Al Gore's communist connection.
In his prepared remarks,
he grabbed that. Yeah.
Lewis touched on a matter. Let's see.
Yeah.
Yes. The news conference at the National Press Club was packed. There were five or six television cameras there, including C-SPAN. The occasion was the release of the book, The Buying of the President 2000, by Charles Lewis. Oh, we interviewed him.
We interviewed Charles.
And the Center for Public Integrity. He's great. Lewis, who previously did investigative reporting at ABC News and CBS, assembled a great deal of information about those who were seeking the presidency and their backers. In his prepared remarks, Lewis touched on a matter that has attracted our interest in the past, Vice President Al Gore's communist connection. But Lewis didn't put it that way. Instead, he referred to Al Gore and the controversial Armin Hammer, the late chairman of Occidental Petroleum. In fact, Hammer was a Soviet agent and a money launderer for the Communist Party who helped Vice President Gore and his family become rich. Lewis explained how, personally and professionally, Gore still brought profits from Occidental largesse. To this day, Lewis said, he draws $20,000 a year from a land deal in Tennessee brokered between his father and Hammer. The total amount is more than $300,000. The personal relationship between young Gore and Hammer was very close throughout the 1980s, including trips on Hammer's private jet and constant campaign contributions. Lewis explained how the Energy Department in 1997 sold 47,000 acres of Federal Reserve to Occidental.
Federal oil reserves.
To Occidental after Vice President Gore, who has a reputation as a staunch environmentalist, recommended that the president give oil companies access to this land.
Although the Energy Department was supposed to review the environmental impact of the sale, it did not. It turned the job over to a private company whose board of directors included Tony Kohl, now the general chairman of Gore's presidential campaign. This had to be. This must have been.
January 26th.
When? Where does it say that?
2000.
Oh, this was written in 2000. Okay. All right. So, anyway, it still has not much left here, but I. His book on buying president goes into much more detail. His book points out that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover wanted to prosecute Hammer for Hoover's believed would attempt to protect him from prosecution. Among them was Al Gore's father. This was a relationship that was transferred from father to son. Al Gore Jr. was dealing with Hammer in the 1980s. The vice president has been the
subject
of countless stories because he has benefited from the campaign money raised from tainted Asian sources. But Charles Lewis has raised a far more important issue, his receipt of money from his relationship with the communist agent. Is there anyone in the media willing to take on this issue? On the matter of Al Gore and the other presidential candidates, Charles Lewis and his Center for Public Integrity have performed a real public service. They are doing the kind of work we should expect from a major media. In terms of print coverage of Lewis's revelations, the Washington Post ran a story on page 5, but it said nothing about Al Gore's communist connection.
Hmm.
So, I don't know, this is on a David Icke site, so I can understand why he put it up there, so people understand that Al Gore was backed by Armin Hammer, who was a communist agent. So,
let's see.
Yeah, a second.
The transhumanist and police state agent agenda in pop music. This might be interesting.
Yeah.
As seen in previous articles on this site, the world's biggest stars exploit common themes in their work, permeating popular culture with a set of symbols and values. The cohesiveness of the message that is communicated to the masses, regardless of the artist's musical genre, attests to the influence of a higher power over the industry. Other articles on this site have explored the way Illuminati symbolism, based on a secret society occultism, has been reflected in popular videos. Exposing and desensitizing the world to this elite sacred symbols is, however, only one aspect of the agenda. Other aspects of the Illuminati's control are reflected in today's popular music as well, including mass mind control, transhumanism, that is, the robotization of the human body, and the gradual introduction of a virtual police state. Through the news, movies, and the music industry, the agenda is being insidiously presented to the masses using various techniques. If the news scares people into accepting measures diminishing their personal freedom and ushering in a new era, the music business accomplishes the same job by making it seem sexy, cool, and trendy. This angle is mainly aimed at the younger crowd, which is more susceptible to take in the industry's message. Maybe a little more on this. This is from the Vigilance Citizen. Let's see.
If you never heard of transhumanism or martial law, I suggest you visit the Educate Yourself section, as I will only provide a very summary explanation of each concept here.
Transhumanism.
You want to get into this?
Yeah, let's just read what that is, what the definition of... I'm not going to read the whole thing, but let's just read the definition of transhumanism.
Okay.
Transhumanism is an international, intellectual, and cultural movement supporting the use of science and technology to improve human mental and physical characteristics and capacities. The movement regards aspects of the human condition, such as a disability, suffering, disease, aging, and involuntary death, as unnecessary and undesirable. Transhumanists look to biotechnologies and other emerging technologies for these purposes. Dangers, as well as benefits, are also of a concern to the transhumanist movement.
Yeah, I mean, if you got a whole world that is being called by, for global population reduction. Why the hell are they, this is obviously an elite medicine, and this is the kind of...
Not necessarily. Let's read more. The term transhumanism is symbolized by H+ or small h+. It is often used as a synonym for human enhancement. Although the first known use of the term dates from 1957, the contemporary meaning is the product of the 1980s, when futurists in the United States began to organize what has since grown into the transhumanist movement. Transhumanist thinkers predict that human beings may eventually be able to transform themselves into beings with such greatly expanded abilities as to merit the label post-human. Transhumanism is therefore referred to as post-humanism, or a form of transformational activism, influenced by post-humanist ideals. The transhumanist vision of a transformed future of humanity has attracted many supporters and detractors from a wide range of perspectives. Transhumanism has been described by one critic, Francis Fukuyama, as the world's most dangerous idea, while one proponent, Reynold Bailey, counters that it is the movement that epitomizes the most daring, courageous, imaginative, and idealistic aspiration of humanity.
What is almost never mentioned is the fact that those technological improvements will be out of reach for the average man.
Mm-hmm.
is what I was saying.
Yeah, just what you
huge
were saying.
Huge price tags on those scientific discoveries will tender them only
accessible. Will render them.
To select elite. While the common man is forced to seek nourishment in genetically modified, chemically altered, and even poisonous foods, the elite is trying to achieve immortality through science. Even if the masses cannot have access to those discoveries, mass media makes transhumanism cool, desirable, and ultimately acceptable. And the interesting thing about this is that I was thinking of Iron Man, which is exactly what that kind of thing is kind of about. You know what I mean? Where he creates that, where he creates that suit, you know, and he can fly and he can do everything else. And Iron Man was pretty good.
The same article discusses the police state, which I think most people know what that is.
Yeah. Let me just go and say something though. I want to examine your single section of the USA Patriot Act. Section 213, definitely one of the most sinister provisions of this monstrous statute. In euphemistic language, that conceals the
provision's momentous significance. Section 213 states that with regard to federal search warrants, any notice required to be given may be delayed if the court finds reasonable cause to believe that providing immediate notification of the execution of the warrant may have adverse results.
The warrant prohibits the seizure of any tangible property except where the court finds reasonable necessity for the seizure. And the warrant provides for the giving of such notice within a reasonable period of its execution, which period may thereafter be extended by the court for good cause shown. Right? Section 213 may be couched in Orwellian terminology, but there is no doubt about what it does. Is the first statute ever enacted in the history of American criminal procedure to specifically authorize an entirely new form of search warrant, what legal scholars call the sneak and peek warrant, also dubbed the covert entry warrant or the surreptitious entry warrant. A sneak and peek search warrant authorizes police to effect physical entry into a private premises without the owner or occupant's permission or knowledge to conduct a search. Generally, such entire entity
entry requires
breaking and entering. So that's exactly what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It goes on even more, and I'm going to suggest that you go to it. I'll tell you where it is. The Vigilant Citizen.
Symbols rule the world, not words, not laws.
So the Vigilant Citizen, and then say .com, just Vigilant Citizen, you probably get it. Yeah, let's go back here. Consumer safety problems are dwarfed by body count of Big Pharma's deadly drugs.
Even as Toyota now finds itself the target of an increasingly hyped-up inquisition about public safety, skeptical consumers are asking the common-sense question, if public safety is so important, then why isn't Congress asking about the dangers of Big Pharma's deadly drugs? Toyota's problems with throttle controls and brakes haven't actually killed anyone as far as we know. Even if deaths have occurred, the number would be extremely small compared to the number of deaths caused by Big Pharma products. FDA-approved pharmaceuticals kill nearly 270 people each day in the U.S. alone. And that's according to conservative calculations published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. That's the equivalent to a jumbo jet airliner falling out of the sky and crashing into a giant ball of flames every single day in the U.S.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Here's something cool, too. Hackers expose security flaws with Elvis Presley passport. In the name of improved security, a hacker showed how a biometric passport issued in the name of long-dead rock and roll King Elvis Presley would be cleared through an automated passport scanning system being tested at an international airport. Using a doctored passport as a self-serve passport machine, the hacker has cleared for travel after just a few seconds and a picture of the king himself appeared on the monitor display. Adam Laurie and Joanne Van Beek, who called themselves ethical hackers, say the exercise exposed how easy it is to fool a passport scanner with a fraudulent biometric chip, and the Presley test was carried out at Amsterdam Schiphol Airport in September 2008 by Laurie and Van Beek, who highlight potential security shortcomings. Amazing.
Debt dynamite. Yeah. The people have been lulled into a false sense of safety under the ruse of perceived economic recovery. Unfortunately, what the majority of people think does not make it so, especially when the people making the key decisions think and act to the contrary. The sovereign debt crisis that have been unfolding in the past couple of years and more recently in Greece are canaries in the coal mine for the rest of the Western civilization. The crisis threatens to spread to Spain, Portugal, and Ireland. Like dominoes, one country after the other will collapse into debt and currency crises all the way to America. In October 2008, the mainstream media and politicians of the Western world were warning of an impending depression if actions were not taken to quickly prevent this. The problem was that this crisis had been a long time coming, and what's worse is that the actions government took did not address any of the core systemic issues and problems with the global economy. They merely set out to save the banking industry from collapse. To do this, governments around the world implemented massive stimulus and bailout packages, plunging their countries deeper into debt to save the banks from themselves while charging it to the people of the world. Then an uproar of stock market speculation followed as money was pumped into the stocks, but not the real economy. This recovery has been nothing but a complete and utter illusion, and within the next 2 years, the illusion will likely come to complete collapse. That's kind of scary.
Let's see what else they say here.
Let's see. The government gave a, let's see. When the crisis is over, the middle classes of the Western world will have been liquidated of their economic, political, and social status. The global economy will have gone through the greatest consolidation of industry and banking in the world history, leading to a system in which only a few corporations and banks control the global economy and its resources. Governments will have lost that right. The people of the Western world will be treated by the financial oligarchs as they have treated the global South, and in particular Africa. They will remove our social structure and foundations so that we become entirely subservient to their dominance over the economic and political structures of our society.
But see, here and again, they're giving too much power to these corporations, and I swear to God, you know, these people are just crooks and thieves, okay? And the world people, I just can't see them taking this anymore. If this thing falls on its face, then we can all go after and kick the living daylights out of these sons of bitches. But, you know, nobody seems to want to do it yet. And they seem to control all the police forces and everything else.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Let me just read a little more.
I think it's going to take...
The Western world has been plundered into poverty, a process long underway, but with the unfolding of the crisis will be rapidly accelerated. As our societies collapse on themselves, the governments will protect the banks and the multinationals. When the people go out into the streets, as they invariably do and will, the government will not come to their aid, but will come out with police and military forces to crush the protests and oppress the people. The social foundations will collapse with the economy, and the state will clamp down to prevent the people from constructing a new one. The road to recovery is far from here. When the crisis has come to an end, the world we know will have changed dramatically. No one ever grows up in the world they were born into. Everything is always changing. Now is no exception. The only difference is that we're about to go through the most rapid changes the world has seen thus far.
Assessing the illusion of recovery. In August of 2009, I wrote an article entering the greatest depression in history, which I analyzed how there is a deep systemic crisis in the capitalist system in which we have gone through merely one burst bubble thus far, the housing bubble, but there remains a great many others. There remains as a significantly larger threat than the house collapse.
Housing collapse, the commercial real estate bubble, as the Deutsche Bank CEO said in May of 2009. It's either the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning. Of even greater significance is what has been termed the bailout bubble, in which governments have superficially inflated the economies through massive debt-inducing bailout packages. As of July 2009, the government watchdog and investigator of the U.S. bailout program stated that the U.S. may have put itself at risk of up to $23.7 trillion. In October of 2009, approximately 1 year following the Great Panic of 2008, I wrote an article titled The Economic Recovery is an Illusion, in which I analyzed what the most prestigious and powerful financial institutions in the world, the Bank for International Settlements, had to say about the crisis and the recovery. The BIS, as well as the former chief economist who had both correctly predicted the crisis that unfolded in 2008, were warning of a future crisis in the global economy, citing the fact that none of the key issues and structure problems with the economy had changed, and that government bailouts may do more harm than good in the long run. No kidding. Right. All they're doing is propping up weak companies.
William White, former chief economist of the BIS, warned the world has not tackled the problem at the heart of the economic turndown and is likely to slip back into recession. He warned that government actions to help the economy in the short run may be sowing the seeds for future crises, crying wolf or castigating Cassandra. While people are being lulled into a false sense of security, prominent voices warning of the harsh bite of reality to come were, instead of being listened to, berated and pushed aside by the mainstream media. Gerald Celente, who accurately predicted the economic crisis of 2008 and who had been warning of a much larger crisis to come, had been accused by the mainstream media of pushing pessimism porn. Celente's response was that he isn't pushing pessimism porn, but that he refuses to push optimism opium, of which the mainstream media does so outstandingly. So are these voices of criticism merely crying wolf, or is it that the media is out to castigate Cassandra? Cassandra is in Greek mythology, was the daughter of King Priam, the queen Hecuba of Troy, who was granted by the god Apollo the gift of prophecy. She prophesied and warned the Trojans of the Trojan horse, the death of Armageddon, and the destruction of Troy. When she warned the Trojans, they simply cast her aside as mad and did not heed her warnings. And while those who warn of a future economic crisis may not have been granted the gift of prophecy from Apollo, they certainly have the ability of comprehension. So what do the Cassandras of the world have to say today? Should we listen?
To understand the global economic crisis, we must understand the global causes of the economic crisis. We must first determine how we got to the initial crises. From there, we can critically assess how governments responded to the outbreak of the crises, and thus we can determine where we currently stand and where we are likely headed. Africa and much of the developing world was released from socio-political economic restraints of the European, European empires.
He goes on into understanding it, and hegemony and neoliberalism and all that. Okay, so, it gets into a real long explanation. Trump finds Riggy holds U.S. issued passport.
Let's see.
Israel turns to U.S. for backup plan against Iran.
And let's see if there's a little video or something where we could play a little something.
Getting into yesterday's stuff here.
Yeah. There's one up further. If you go up, it's, if you go back, you may have a little.
Okay.
Right there.
Right here. UK politics and Israel lobby.
The video shows how the power of the Israeli lobby over British political parties, and don't think it's any different here.
Ah.
So let's see what they have to say.
Okay. Big story.
For some critics of the pro-Israel lobby, their relationship with the politicians is one thing, but what is perhaps more frightening is if polls are to be believed, the conservatives with whom the pro-Israel lobby have the most cozy relationship might just form the majority here in the next general election.
Any future British Conservative government would be disproportionately influenced by the pro-Israel lobby. This was the claim of a major documentary on Channel 4, one of the UK's top domestic broadcasters. The Dispatch's programme entitled Inside Britain's Israel Lobby, presented by journalist and columnist Peter Auburn, established the existence of a well-connected, well-funded organisation operating primarily through parliamentary channels.
Take out the battery.
Chief amongst these was the Conservative Friends of Israel, or CFI. According to the Dispatch's programme, at least 50% of the shadow cabinets were members of CFI, with sources close to the organisation claiming at least 80% of Conservative MPs were CFI members. The Jewish population in the United Kingdom is thought to be some 270,000, making it one of the smallest in terms of numbers, but according to public and estimated figures, CFI has donated nearly $17 million to the Conservative Party since 2001. The fear is, as well as domestic influence, foreign policy decisions could rest on this level of patronage. It's the idea of a foreign power having direct access to the corridors of British government that sits uneasily with MP George Galloway.
Orban's voice cannot be ignored. He is, as I say, one of the most senior journalists in Britain. And what he has apparently uncovered is a network of support that is being woven inside the British Conservative Party by the Friends of Israel, to the extent that even David Cameron's office itself has been infiltrated and is being partly financed by people whose actual agenda is to ensure that Israel's interests rather than Britain's interests are secured.
Whilst the existence of the pro-Israel lobby comes as a surprise to few, it is their scope, reach, and political implication of bias that worries many. With Britain continuing to play a role in the Middle East politics and its aftermath, the idea that any UK government would come to the negotiating table serving the interests of any one side so blatantly would be a political disaster. But this is exactly what is possible if the Dispatch's claims hold true. Already, Shadow Foreign Secretary William Hague was censored by a senior CFI member and Conservative Party donor who objected to Hague's referral to Israel's use of force against Lebanon in the 2006 war as disproportionate. During Israel's bombardment of Gaza this year, the Conservatives were silent, and only weeks ago William Hague called on Britain to reject the Goldstone report on Gaza. The current Labour government did not escape criticism, with Labour Friends of Israel coming in for special mention. The chief election fundraiser for Gordon Brown has boasted that former Prime Minister and current Middle East peace envoy Tony Blair was a constant fixture at LFI meetings. With the media fallout from the Dispatches programme still in full swing, some are asking why is it still taboo to question the uncomfortable relationship between the corridors of British power and the interest of Israel.
Now, was it a brave decision for UK domestic broadcaster to screen a programme on the Israel lobby and its influence on British politics?
I think it was a brave measure, just because it's not one that's discussed extensively. I think it was an important one, actually, to have aired on TV.
The tape is still running there.
Huh. Why? I wonder why that stopped.
No, it's just got this. Sometimes YouTube does that. And it's just catching up.
Oh, okay.
Buffers the video.
Do you think we'll get more?
Yeah, we'll probably get it.
It's not very much different from the Israeli lobby here.
No, it's the same kind of thing. Let's see, sometimes it's got others.
Oh, it's almost 8:30,
yeah.
So
we have our
interview.
Okay. So, yeah, that YouTube story is kind of like a shot. Okay.
Yeah, that's
the same thing. The same thing's happening here, you know, so it's like...
Except it's been in place longer, I think.
Cities are shortening yellow traffic lights for a deadly profit. Living through the 21st century addicted to technology and surveillance, citizens may be too overwhelmed to complain of increasing cameras popping up atop red lights at intersections across the nation, most of which are designed to catch them breaking traffic laws. That is, until they're caught in those intersections as the yellow lights unexpectedly change and cars in front and back of them hit the brakes or punch the gas to avoid tickets. And then they get out those cameras and lights that are being gamed, sometimes lethally, in the pursuit of quick profit. Then they get mad, and maybe even for being used as motorized money pits. With all of the stories we are hearing on a daily basis, there is little doubt that the desire for ticket revenue trumps safety concerns, Bill Biller, executive director of National Motorist Association, told Alternet. A quick current example of California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who a few weeks ago proposed state budgets, including a proposal to add speed sensors to 500 existing traffic light cameras. The reason? Safety wasn't mentioned, but an expected additional revenue of $338 million was.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine the sons of bitches. Yeah, that's Mr. Schwarzenegger.
Well, they're desperate in California to raise money.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Anyway, I'm going to go back to the switchboard here. And, so that's that. And we're going to do our interview with
Yosef
Manamir and the Palestinian Center. And
he'll explain what it is, and he'll give some websites and a blog.
Yeah,
and if
they
you're interested,
and he talks
and you can
about,
get in touch.
He talks about the Gaza and Israeli occupation of Palestine. And
the struggle of the Palestinian people.
And how the Palestinian Center has a wealth of information, of news and information on the issues, videotapes, all
but
articles.
They sure have an uphill battle to affect the difference.
But they've been there since 1991, so...
They're trying.
So anyway, we're going to have that interview right now, and I hope you enjoy it, and we'll be back right after that.
Name is, let me get it straight here. His name is Mr. Yosef Munayur, and he's the executive director of the Jerusalem Front and its educational program, the Palestinian Center. Prior to joining the Palestinian Center, Munayur served as a political analyst for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, the nation's largest Arab-American membership organization. He received his BA in political science and history from the University of Massachusetts Amherst and an MA in government and politics from the University of Maryland. His doctoral research focuses on political conflict, interstate and domestic conflict, as well as the micro foundations of ethnic cleansing and political repression. He frequently writes on matters of foreign policy in the Arab and Muslim world and civil rights and civil liberty issues in the United States. His op-eds have appeared regularly in numerous national papers such as the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, the Boston Globe, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Detroit Free Press, and others. He's been asked to comment on national and international media outlets such as MSNBC, CBS, Al Jazeera English, C-SPAN, Air America Radio, and CBS Radio. So he's a guest on a lot of places. And
so welcome to the show.
We're glad to have him.
How are you? Can you hear us all right?
It's good to be with you.
Great.
So we've introduced the center and yourself and we'd like to know. The first question is: can you tell us about your Jerusalem Fund and the Palestinian Center, and tell us about the upcoming events and what issues you're covering at this moment?
Sure. Well, the Jerusalem Fund, it's actually the short name for the Jerusalem Fund for Education and Community Development, which was founded back in 1977 and has been working for Palestinians in a number of different ways since then. And it began really as a charity that provided scholarships for Palestinians who were disadvantaged because of the situation, and grew to have a number of different programs, including the Palestine Center, which is a think tank that was founded in 1991 to provide a much-needed Palestinian perspective into the policy arena and the general discourse in the United States about the Israeli-Palestinian issue and U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East in general, as well as a cultural program called The Gallery, which showcases Arab and Palestinian art to combat stereotypes about Arabs and Palestinians and Muslims in general. We have a number of programs that go on pretty much on a weekly basis, and all of our programs can be watched live. We webcast all our events on our website and on our blog, and I'd encourage your listeners to check them out. The website is thejerusalemfund.org, or you could also check out the blog at thepalestinecenterblog.org. And get connected in a number of different ways, including Facebook and Twitter and through podcasts. You can find us all over the place. And check out some of the live streaming lectures that we have, video presentations, PowerPoint presentations, picture slideshows, statistics, information maps. We're really just trying to be a resource to give people an idea of what's really going on the ground in the Middle East.
Oh, good. So in your role at the Palestinian Center, such as you do a lot of educational programs, do you work to educate the Congress at all?
Well, as a 501c3, you know, we stay away from what would be considered lobbying.
Oh, okay.
So we do act to educate in a number of different ways, including holding public events and lectures in Washington, D.C., and we regularly have policymakers in the audience, including staff from the various policymaking arms of the United States. We're located in Foggy Bottom, and mm-hmm. for those of you out there who know Washington, D.C., that's where the State Department is located. And there was no mistake in our having an office there, because we regularly have, you know, members of the State Department staff coming in to hear the different points of view that Palestinian speakers are making available through the Palestine Center.
But you're not, it doesn't seem like you're getting much positive response from the Congress here on anything to do with Gaza or the Palestinian issue. It seems to be all pro-Israeli and pro-genocide, basically. What are you seeing as far as progress being made?
Well, I can't remember who said it, but a long time ago it was said that Capitol Hill is also part of the occupied territories. And it's no secret that the Israeli lobby and Israeli advocacy groups have a great deal of sway on Capitol Hill and have had, you know, a significant amount of influence for a long time. I really don't see that changing into the immediate future, and I think that things will only change when Americans realize that the policies in the Middle East are not only against the interests of Palestinians, but also against the interests of Americans themselves.
Absolutely. But on a positive note, I just read that French President Nicolas Sarkozy has called for a rapid resumption of Middle East peace talks. He also has called for a Palestinian state, and it should be drawn up based on the 1967 borders.
So, yeah, he just came out with that today, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But do you trust his
support?
Support. I mean, he was.
No, it's not so much about Nicolas Sarkozy or his predecessor, whoever comes after him, or any other Western or non-Western leader who engages this issue. It's really about the history of this this peace process,
mm-hmm.
if that's what we are to call it. We've heard these sort of commitments and recommitments and recommitments of commitments to a Palestinian state and so on and so forth for years on end. But even though we have had this peace process going on for 18 years now based on a two-state framework, we've only seen the continued colonization of Palestinian land through the expansion of settlements and the security infrastructure that surrounds them, including the apartheid wall and checkpoints and roadblocks that are carving up the living spaces that Palestinians have left. And all of this being done while the West not only turns a blind eye, but actually supports Israel in the process. So, you know, while I'm happy to hear different Western leaders say they want peace, unfortunately, their actions over time have led too many of us to believe these to be disingenuous.
Well, I think it was the other thing that was kind of funny about Sarkozy was when he showed up in Haiti and he got thousands and thousands of people, came out and protest against him, and for the replacement of Aristide. So it's like as the legitimate government there, but it's just funny that he has such he's worldly known as a globalist and as a one. I thought he actually supported Zionism, but it looks like he doesn't. What's your opinion of him?
Well, you know, honestly, I don't know. I don't know very much about where he stands, on the precise matters of this conflict. But he tends to sort of follow the line that has been dictated from Washington about a two-state solution and what's needed for peace, and the endless regurgitation of talking points that have led us to where we are today, which is really further away from a solution than we were 18 years ago when this peace process started.
Well, how does the center, or you and the center, view the current Palestinian Authority, or the is it Abbas?
Yeah, we don't take any positions. We're an independent organization and don't take any positions towards any particular government.
Yeah.
We do, however, feel very strongly about the legitimate grievances of the Palestinian people, which transcend any differences between Palestinian governments or Arab governments.
I'm sorry. I was just curious about your opinion of Hamas. With the, how are they viewed by most of the Palestinians? Are they still accepted as the legitimate government?
Well, they were democratic.
What we're seeing now very clearly is that there's a great division in Palestinian society, and it's certainly not the first time. It's really just division being extended and exacerbated. When the Oslo Accords were signed, we saw a great division between those Palestinians living in the occupied territories and then the diaspora community, which felt betrayed by the Oslo Accords.
Right.
Now, after this peace process has dragged on, and the evolution of the PA being what it is and what it has been, being alleged to be corrupt and turning its back on the majority of Palestinians, and many people have said this, we're seeing even further division now, not only between the Palestinians in and outside of Palestine, but within the Palestinians inside Palestine. If anything, what we see now is really a continuation of division in the Palestinian national movement, which really has been the intention of the occupier and only plays into the hand of the occupier.
Well, I just read an article tonight on Netanyahu authorizing the assassination of the of Hamas's leader in January in Tel Aviv. Were you aware of that?
Well, I don't think there's been any. The Israelis have this policy where they don't confirm or deny these things, and right now they're in a very difficult position internationally because a lot of people have started to realize that what the Israelis are up to is no good, and they're losing a lot of legitimacy internationally. And because of that, botched operations like this, where the identities of these agents are pretty much compromised, don't reflect well not only on Israel internationally, but also on the government and its domestic audience. Look, Israel has been behind the assassination of Palestinian officials for decades.
Oh, absolutely.
And Mahmoud al-Makhrouh is just one of many Palestinians who have been assassinated covertly and overtly. And you know, certainly the Israelis have, very overtly shot Hellfire missiles into the cars of Hamas leaders and have conducted, you know, covert missions where they've killed Palestinian leaders overseas, and this is certainly not anything new. And just because the Israelis aren't admitting it, doesn't mean it wasn't them. Their fingerprints are all over.
It says here that on this particular article, it says Interpol has issued red notices for 11 suspects to help find and arrest them anywhere in its 188 member countries. So they actually have, because of these guys carried their European passports. Pretty much exposed who they were, and now.
Remember, this is a crime.
Yeah, of course.
And this has legal implications internationally because it happened across borders and using obviously forged documents.
Yep.
And so the international community should take this seriously, regardless to who the perpetrator or the victim may have been.
Absolutely.
No, this article says that Netanyahu actually authorized the assassination of a senior Hamas official in early January, and that's why Interpol is after
them. And they used European passports, I think.
Yes, I heard
that.
11 European passports. Mm-hmm. They're German and English, I believe, and some other. But I was just curious of your opinion on that, but... what do you think is the, from what you can see, what can we expect the future outcome of Palestine to be? I mean, the way it looks now, unless somebody seriously steps in or unless the United States gets some backbone, stands up and stops supporting Israel, which, is about the only way, then what's the future? What does the future look like for the Palestinians?
Well, unfortunately, the immediate future in my forecast is very dismal.
Yeah.
It's clear that the occupying power, the Israelis, and their biggest supporters, the United States, are far too overpowering for people like the Palestinians who have been decimated for the past 60 years. Adding on to that, the Palestinian national movement is devoid of all leadership. Any and all leadership that is present now has no legitimacy among the people, and this has been a graduate process of destroying the Palestinian leadership through delegitimization and also assassination over time. What exists now is the Palestinian people and their will to persist on the land which is theirs, and that will ultimately deliver the Palestinian people is their persistence and their willingness to stick to the land which they're from and which they want to continue to be living on. And ultimately, you know, apartheid regimes, they cannot sustain themselves forever. And I think that the power of the sort of resistance movements, the nonviolent resistance movements, the popular resistance movements, ultimately will be too much for the state of Israel to bear when trying to continue its apartheid system.
Recently, today I read something that I found very disturbing, and that is that a fellow at Harvard University's Weatherhead Center for International Affairs, Martin Kramer, has called for the West to take measures to curb the births of Palestinians, a proposal that appears to meet the international legal definition of a call for genocide. I think the part that disturbs me most is these people, this fellow is at Harvard University. And
that's a land-grant university.
Right.
And after what they've done to the Indian population in this country, to hear that coming out of that institution is outright.
It's outrageous.
It's outrageous, and it's almost criminal. What it is criminal. I mean, what's your opinion on that?
Well, I I mean, I think obviously, look, Martin Kramer has never been a friend of Palestinians, and in fact, he's been an unabashed apologist for, you know, criminal Israeli policies
right.
for a long time. So it certainly doesn't surprise me that someone like him would make a statement like this. However, I think the standard we need to judge this by is, you know, the simple standard of replacing Palestinians with any other ethnic group. And if such a comment was made about Jews or blacks or any other ethnic group, you know, we'd have an uproar, and obviously this person would no longer have any affiliations in the liberal Western world at all, at least one would hope. So obviously it's appalling, and I know he's attempted to defend himself and say that I was taken out of context, but I listened to the entirety of his speech at the Herzliya conference, and what really he was calling for was eugenics and creating policies to limit the growth of the Palestinian population in any way you slice it, dice it, or try to dress it up. That is in no way compatible with modern liberal standards and human rights, and someone like that should certainly not be affiliated with Harvard or any other institution of higher learning.
Absolutely.
There was another real crackpot, this Adolphus Lieberman. I think the first name was Adolphus. But Lieberman was Avigdor Lieberman, who was a member of the Likud, and he was the he stood up in front of the parliament and said that he wanted all 13 year old Palestinian boys should be killed. All right, and then a month later he was invited to the United States to meet the Congress.
Avigdor Lieberman is he's.
Yeah, I just have to turn the tape over. Start up with
Arabs living within Israel and how they constitute a threat to the Israeli population, how they should be forced to swear loyalty to the Israeli public. And you know, what's really disturbing about Lieberman and his party is that it has now become the third largest party in Israel.
Yeah.
And that there's a number of sympathetic followers to that sort of ideology. And it's really symbolic of the shift the Israeli public has taken to the right, and not just to the right, but to the extreme right when it comes to dealing with Palestinians. And, you know, his party, now the third largest in Israel, is part of the government of Benjamin Netanyahu and occupies some very important cabinet ministries. So these are the sorts of people who the Palestinians are supposed to negotiate with. And with that reality, it's very hard to see any agreement.
Virtually Nazism is what they're talking about here. I mean, this is like Hitler's plan, all right, to annihilate, destroy the entire,
the
entire
population.
People. I mean, they're taking it right from Mein Kampf and Hitler's plans for
the reason behind this sort of rhetoric is that, you know, we have to look back at the history of Israel, and how this conflict came to be. Israel was conceived to be a Jewish state in a territory where Jews were a minority. So this issue of demographics has always been, you know, a paranoia for them, that if, you know, what happens if the Arabs start having more kids, that it suddenly becomes an existential threat for them. And all of that has to do with the founding of the state, a state that was founded through colonial conquest and through ethnic cleansing, and obviously without justice and a rectification for what happened then, we're going to continue to see these sort of problems until today. So as much as it is difficult to deal with that sort of rhetoric, we have to place it in the context of history and realize that without solving these foundational problems, we're going to be hearing about demographic threats regardless to a two-state solution. If you had a two-state solution tomorrow, you'd still have 20% of the population in Israel being Arab, with a much higher birth rate than the Israeli population, still living in an ethnocentric state, which has no place for them within the political structure, within the national structure. So these sorts of questions are going to come up again. It's a question of state identity and really about liberalism and human rights, whether or not everybody is welcome within a political structure. And the way that Israel was conceived, Arabs were not supposed to be there. But they are, and they were, and they continue to be. And until the Israeli leadership and the Israeli people realize that, we're going to continue to have this conflict.
How do you account for the shift to the right that Israel is having?
Well, you know, it's really a shift that's been going on for a number of years now, and it's because of really a destruction of the left wing in Israel. The party that was in control prior to the coup was the party of Kadima, which was led by Tzipi Livni, was in fact nothing but defectors from Likud that were still right-wingers but just disagreed about one issue. So the two largest parties now, Kadima and Likud, are both right-wing parties. The third largest party, which is Lieberman's party, Israel Beiteinu, is even further to the right. So this has been a process that's been happening for a long time, and really it's been because of a weakness in the left and also because of ethnic politics within Israel.
And one last question I had for you. From the Palestinian Center, since you have educational programs, do you work within colleges and universities to affect change among young people?
I'm sorry, what was that? I heard colleges and universities.
At the Palestinian Center, you have educational programs. Do you try to work with college-age students in colleges and universities? Because it's through the young people who are coming.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We try to do a number of things. I'm actually, I try to connect with a number of different universities and speak there. I'm going to be at UMass Amherst at some point in April, which I think is in your neck of the woods.
Very close to it.
And we also obviously we have an internship program where we try to bring in youth to work not only in our office but also get to understand how Washington works. And build a community of young leaders that will bring us into the future. And we've done a number of things with social media to reach to an entirely different demographic than really the traditional media has been able to reach before. And I encourage your listeners to check that all out on our website and connect to us via Facebook and Twitter and check out our streaming videos on podcasts and so on.
Do you find... Now, have you found that what is the opinion and what is the consensus of people that are refugees now and people that are on a right of return? I mean, that has been nullified, it's been canceled, it's been not even spoken about anymore in the news or anywhere that I've heard. That it's viable. They ruled against this, didn't they not? There is no right of return anymore.
Well, no Palestinian leader can get away with saying that there's no right of return. And no agreement without a just solution for the refugee issue can be made. It's political suicide for any Palestinian leader. And, of course, there's a lot of pressure on Palestinian leaders to do that. But... It's within the Palestinian community, in and outside of the West Bank and Gaza, the right of return is still a very, very important issue.
I would think it would be, but you just don't really hear it right now anymore, and you don't hear it mentioned.
Well, and that's really because we've seen this continued colonization of Palestine.
That's right.
We stopped talking about 1948 because of the tragedy of 1967, and then we stopped even talking about the 67 lines because of all the facts on the ground that have transpired since then. So Israel creates these new realities, these new yesterdays for Palestinians to look back to and wish they could go back to. But the foundation of the problem problem is at 1948, and without an agreement that brings some justice to what happened in 1948, it's unlikely that you will have a lasting solution.
Yeah, I agree with you. I have to agree with you. There's an upcoming event coming up at the center. I think it was it today or was it recently that.
Tomorrow we have a film screening on the refugee issue.
That's what it was. I saw.
And then that's taking place tomorrow night. The film will be available online on our blog as the film is being screened at the center. And we'll live stream a discussion as well afterwards so viewers around the world can participate through different chat services like Twitter and a chat box that we'll have up there. And then on the 5th, we have a gallery opening on March 5th to showcase some art. And on the 18th of March, we have another event to talk about the different types of government in the West Bank and Gaza. And all that information can be found on our website.
Now, what is the movie about tomorrow? What is that specifically?
The movie tomorrow is specifically the sixth part of a six-part series on the refugee issue. What the filmmaker did, it's a documentary. What the filmmaker did is he actually traveled to 18 different countries to interview Palestinian refugees and actually ask them, what do you think about a number of different issues, including the right of return, because since Oslo, this community has been pretty much ignored in the decision-making structures of the Palestinian national movement.
Yes.
That'd be very interesting.
I know. Are all the other five parts on the Internet, or are they available to look at, or...?
The filmmaker has a website where I think you can access the films. Tomorrow we'll have the part that we're showing available online in its entirety.
And what is the filmmaker's name?
Adam Shapiro. And the name of the series is Chronicles of a Refugee.
The what of a refugee?
Chronicles of a Refugee.
Chronicles of a Refugee, okay. And it's by
Adam Shapiro.
And do you know what his website is offhand?
You know, I think it's chroniclesofrefugee.com or .org, but I could be wrong.
Probably if a Google ad.
It's chroniclesofarefugee.org.
Okay.
That'd be great to look at. But is there anything else that we've just got a few more minutes? But is there anything else that you wanted to mention about your organization, or if there's anything our listeners might be able to do, or places they can go, or anything else that you want them to know about?
Well, I know I've said it a number of times before, but I really encourage people to check out the website. We've got so much material up there that is really historically relevant and very much relevant today. We've got every lecture that we've had there in the past several years available on video on our website, streaming video, as well as MP3 and MP4 files and podcasts and so on. So it's really a resource for people out there. It's also a resource for educators out there. If you're looking for ways to talk about the Middle East to your class, we've got a number of resources that people can use to really bring experts into the classroom, and it's all available on video. So it's a great resource, and I encourage people to check it out.
Well, we thank you very much, Yosef. It sounds like you all are working very hard at the Jerusalem Fund to educate people on the Palestinian issue, and keep up the good work.
Okay.
Because there's no right face to genocide. I don't care what people say.
And I suggest that. That's what I did. I signed up for your updates.
Updates.
And so on.
Yeah.
And they've been good. I've enjoyed reading them. So thank you, Yosef. Is there, and I just say JerusalemFund.org.
That's right.
That's correct. And thank you guys very much for having me.
You're welcome. Good night.
Good night.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye.
And that was Yosef Munir, Executive Director of the Jerusalem Fund and its educational programs, the Palestinian Center. And you can go to the see, the JerusalemFund.org, or you can go to the PalestinianCenter.org.
Right.
And if you're interested in that film, the film was by Adam Shapiro, Chronicles of a Refugee. You could go to that site, chroniclesofarefugee.org.
No,
and we have station ID.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to thank everybody for listening. Hope you enjoyed that. And I'll be back tomorrow night as we venture into the more spiritual realm. Thanks for listening. Good night.